when Michael Jordan at Medina was trying to mess with me and get in my face at the Ryder Cup to try and do what he wanted to do, to put the influence to try and turn our match out so the Americans win that match. And I think the biggest compliment that anybody could have ever given any individual is from one of the greatest in sport today that's ever lived. He's trying to mess with me. So he didn't have to say anything. It was what he did in his own right, which actually inspired me to play even better and bring out the best in me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Talent Takes Practice. This is a podcast looking at what it takes to make it to the top of your chosen field and how we can use this experience to help young people maximise their talents, whatever the talents may be. And today, we've got a great guest. We're speaking to one of the country's top golfers, Ian Poulter, part of six winning Ryder Cup teams from 2004 to 2018. He's been as high as five in the world, two World Golf Championships, plays on both the US and European tours. But, and we're going to have to bring this up with him, Robbie, he has yet to win a major, which is one of the key conditions of being a great golfer. And Rob, I know,
is it?
Harsh.
Is it?
It's harsh.
Is it?
Don't you think? Winning a major, what, so, no?
Hang on. Were you a great table tennis player?
No. I was a good, but not great.
So basically then, to be a great footballer, you have to win the World Cup.
No, not in football. You don't have to win the World Cup because George Best was a great footballer. But
that's my point. So if you're in the top five in the world at one point in your career, that says to me you're a great golfer.
Well,
you disagree?
Well, it depends on how one defines greatness. But I'll tell you this, Rob, winning a major.
Can I just tell you something quickly? So I was out with my wife before lockdown. That comes as a surprise. Yeah. And we were in a restaurant and we were chatting away. And the guy who owns the restaurant came over and we were chatting about French Bulldogs. And then we talked about golf. And this is true. And you're not going to believe it. So she said, oh, my mum's dad or granddad played golf. I went, all right, yeah, all right. Was he any good? Yeah, she said, yeah, he was good. I went, really? And my wife never talked sport. So we're sitting there, we're eating away, and he said, oh, did he play? She went, yeah, he played, yeah. He won a tournament. He won a few tournaments. I went, really? What one? She went, the Open.
No.
I said, pardon? Yeah. I said, pardon? And his name was John Ball. And John Ball was the first amateur to win the British Open.
Wow.
And he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, well, that shows you, Robbie, we won a major. The Open Championship is one of the four truly great tournaments. In fact, for me, it's one of the top two. The Masters and the Open, I think, are the two
biggest. But that wasn't the moral of the story. The moral of the story was you were going to be surprised that my wife told me after 15 years of marriage that great-great-granddad won the Open.
This is your wife's... I thought
yes.
It was somebody... Oh, my... Okay, so I lost the will to live halfway through this. I thought you were talking to someone
my wife.
The restaurant.
Your wife. Wife! Yes!
That's ridiculous.
So John Ball is my wife's mother's either father or grandfather.
Let me ask you this. 1890-odd,
he won the Open.
But did she... Okay, but I want to speak to Sarah here because she may have told you this like 10 years ago, 12 years
no,
ago.
No, never told forgot. Me. Never told
That's
me.
That's amazing.
Never told me. You know, and my wife's father, so my father-in-law, has the carriage clock he won by winning it.
I've got to tell you, that is incredible.
I know.
To have a member of the family and then to find out after so many years of marriage. But that, what does that tell you? Does that tell you that Sarah doesn't tell you that much?
I've no idea.
Yeah, you're getting worried now. Really. Are you getting nervous?
But to find that out about golf, it's just quite remarkable, really. But listen, this is a great conversation to have. How do you define greatness in golf?
Yep.
Well, I think if you're in the top 10 or top 20, you're a great golfer. Do you play golf?
No, I don't play that much. I did when I was in my late teens. I got down to about 14 handicap. You?
I'm off 18. So do you think then as a table tennis player, hand-to-eye coordination. You should be really good at golf, no?
Yeah, but the weird thing, Rob,
if you're putting the bounce, the 10,000 hours into play.
Yeah, but the weird thing, Rob, is that if I try and play tennis, and we still haven't had our challenge match, by the way, we've got to get that on. I get asked this on Twitter, badminton, short tennis, when we go to centre parts, I'm good. Golf, it's different because you've got this long, thin stick, and then you have that tiny shaft, you know, the shaft. You have that long, thin shaft, and then at the bottom you have a piece of metal. And I find the technique in golf really difficult. I had a natural fade, a natural kind of slice, really. And I really admire, Rob, I'd be interested in your view on this. It's a solitary sport. You can practice on your own. You know, Tiger Woods, 100 putts from 6 feet.
You can practice table tennis on your own. You can practice football on your own. No?
Yeah, but not really though, because table tennis you need a very good player at the other end of the table in order to get.
You can put the one side of the table tennis table up. No.
No, because it's not a realistic... Yeah, you can. You can knock it back and forth.
You can practice.
No, you can't. Because what you need in table tennis, you need a very good quality opponent firing the ball at you with spin, changes of direction, and all of those different tactical components to really build skill. Football, you can. But, you know, we're talking with Brendan Rodgers last week, and he was saying that, you know, match-based activity can also help probably more than the individual skill. But golf, there is no interactivity. You know, no one can do anything to you on a golf course. It's not like a tennis match where somebody hits it to your forehand and you have to respond to what they're doing. In golf, you're on your own. I mean, if somebody's higher up the leaderboard, you might need to take more risks. But I think that's a different mental challenge to what you and I had.
I played in the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth with crowds. It was so nerve-wracking.
What was it like on the first tee?
Horrific, you know, like when I'd done Strictly, the first dance in Strictly, you know, because you're out of your comfort zone, even though, you know, I'm an 18 handicapper, I was just thinking, concentrate on hitting it straight or just get it off the ground,
yeah.
You know, but the pressure when you're outside your comfort zone was quite intense, but I'd done all right. I actually done all right.
Where did the ball go off the first tee?
I'm not sure. The first time I played, not far. The second time was all right. But you just want to get off that first tee, and it's the pressure you're under. But yeah. But I'm sure that, you know, I'd like to ask Ian if he was to walk out in front of 50,000 people and kick a football, how would he feel? It's like you, Matthew, at table tennis. You know, what would you have been like if you had to play in a game of football in front of 50,000 people? Like, just say if you had to play in Soccer Aid, you know, obviously you couldn't because you're not famous enough. But if you did... But if you did, how would you feel? Would you be nervous?
I'd find that intimidating. Although I've got to tell you, football less than golf, because with football there are other people on the pitch. There's 22 players. You can pass it sideways if you're feeling really under pressure. In golf, I'm guessing it'd be interesting to see what Ian says about this. You're on your own, and a tiny bit out with the trajectory of the club onto the ball, and you can go out of bounds to the right or left. I'm amazed, Rob, how often you see people melting down on the final 18 holes of a major. Think of Greg Norman and in the Masters, you know, or even Rory McIlroy when he was leading the US.
What about the guy? Was it the French guy?
John van der Velde. Yeah.
Who went in the water.
Unbelievable. John van der Velde.
Was it? Yeah, that was incredible, wasn't
it? That was absolutely
incredible. But do you think you can relate then, Matthew? Obviously, all the books you've wrote, 10,000 hours, you can apply... If you apply 10,000 hours to golf, can you become an expert in that?
Well, there was a guy called Dan who called it the Dan Plan. And I think he trained for like 7,000-8,000 hours and got down to a 2 handicap. So you can definitely build... Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what Ian says about that. But do me a favour, Rob. When Ian comes on, don't mention that I said you needed a major to be a great... Because don't be mischievous about this. But we should ask him about it, though.
No, you said you're not a great golfer if you've not won a major. I totally disagree.
Not an all-time great. I mean, an all-time great. Don't you think? Tell me in football, what would be the criterion of greatness in football for you?
Longevity.
Yep.
Probably how many trophies you've won. But the thing is, you can say, if Harry Kane doesn't win a major trophy, would he be a great?
That's difficult, isn't it? Because he's such a brilliant player. And you know that if he was playing at Real Madrid or you know, Liverpool under Klopp, or...
Is Colin Montgomery a great?
That's the classic one. That's the classic one, because he was so good for so long. He was brilliant player.
You said
player.
You can't beat a great golfer.
I'll tell you what.
I would say, if you are in the top 50 of golfers for a consistent period... Yeah. You're a great golfer.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting debate, and I'm looking forward to...
But you disagree.
Hey, by the way, on the team and individual, he was a brilliant team player. I mean, when you think of is it Medina or Medina? I can't remember. But, you know, that the chest pump, you know, the just incredible. And he wasn't just playing brilliantly. I think he inspired a lot of his teammates. So maybe he finds an individual sport difficult.
But he doesn't. Because he's in the top five.
But what I mean is, but maybe he'd be number one if it was a team sport. He kind of draws off the inspiration.
Do you really want to do this podcast when he comes on? Wow. Wow, right then. Maybe he'd have been good if he'd have had a team. Why don't you just do football, Ian? Wow.
Oh, wow. Mate. Okay, let's just start the whole podcast all over again. I'm going to start by saying... It's all about the Ryder Cup. No, I'm not. But listen, we're just about to be joined by Impolta. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Is it hot? Is it hot in that room, you know? Look a bit embarrassed there.
So we're now joined by Ian Poulter. Thank you, Ian, for coming on the podcast, which, as you know, it's about how to maximise our potential in sport, in life. We have young people aspiring to be sports stars on listening in. We also have parents interesting how to develop young people, not just in sport, but in life. So we're fascinated to hear your perspective. But can I just start with this question? When did you realise that you wanted to be a golfer? How young were you?
That's a funny story as well, because I actually had a couple of trials with Tottenham, and they said I wasn't very good. That's the polite version. They said I wasn't any good. So the rebound of that was, no one's going to tell me what to do type of thing. So I took it really personally, and it was quite a big hit to the confidence levels. And my second love was always golf. And at that stage, I literally switched completely off of football. I barely played another game of football from the age of 15. And at that point, I really focused on my golf. So it was down to the scouts at Tottenham, thankfully.
Wow.
Being an Arsenal supporter, that got me 100% focused on my golf.
So, Paul, going back to that then, you know, to be told you weren't good enough at an early age, how did that affect you?
Well, there was a number of factors within that which I think were the issue. I was also told by my school teachers as well, because I used to take my golf clubs into class. I used to put them on the side of my desk, and then between break time, I'd go out on the football pitches and I'd hit golf balls. And I remember one of my teachers came, dragged me out of class. I was obviously messing with my golf clubs, and he pulled me out of class and was jabbing me in my chest and just basically said that I would never be a golfer and I was a complete waste of time. So to have, you know, to have kind of that as a motivation of, I've been told I'm not good enough at football, I've been told I'm never going to make it as a golfer, and I'm a complete waste of time, was kind of the fuel that kind of put the burning desire in me to basically turn that around and say, you know, screw you, I'm going to make it the whole way. And you know, from that point on was really the dedication to work hard, be the best person I possibly can from a sports perspective, and not have anybody tell me again that I was never going to be good enough.
How old were you, Pop, Ian, at the time? Because to get trials at Spurs, you must have been a considerable footballer. And how old were you when you were taking the clubs?
I'm not sure.
What kind of a school was it?
We had virtually no outside. I mean, listen, we're talking about Tottenham. I wasn't that good. Come on. Nah, you know, there was a couple of lads from the club that I played with that, you know, that also had trials. They were better players. So, you know, I had two trials. It was at, you know, very early stages. And there was loads of kids. And to be honest, it was actually demoralizing. I thought I was pretty good. I felt that, you know, I could pretty much do whatever it was I could. And then you get in a room with, you know, 100 kids and realize that there are some, obviously, some really good talent there as well. So it was harsh reality very quickly that it's kind of, it was just one in, one out, one in, one out, one in, one out. Very, very little time. And I guess in football, that's it may be the norm today. There may be so many kids that want to become, you know, great players, and there's not enough places for them to play.
So, you know, would you say that at an early age, you know, Matthews wrote the book, hasn't he, Bounced to 10,000 Hours. Would you say your natural ability was more gravitated towards football than golf?
100%. For the first 15 years, I was, you know, I was hell-bent on wanting to become a footballer. I literally, I loved the team environment. I loved what it meant to be part of the team. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to set up goals. I wanted to defend. I wanted to, you know, take free kicks. I wanted to be the player in the team that was a team player. And I loved the fact of, you know, what it meant to win. And, you know, it's completely the opposite about golf. So, yeah. You know, to have that love and passion at an early age of being part of a team and then take that away to become a selfish individual was two very different dynamics.
That's so interesting because we were talking before you came on, Ian, about what that must be like, because you have excelled in the one format. I mean, you've excelled in many different ways, but that format of team competition in golf, it's almost like you take the inspiration from the people around you, inject it into the other people in your team. And yet, as a golfer, you talked about having to be selfish. You know, it's an isolating experience, I'm guessing. It's all on you. Given your gregariousness, you know, you're a sociable person. What was it like to be disciplined enough to hit balls on your own, different weathers, you know, and how did you manage to create the mindset that enabled you to do that, given that you weren't naturally attracted to that kind of way of playing?
There's a way that I looked at that. And I think obviously having the being rejected as a football player and told you're not good enough kind of spurred me for the simple fact of, you know, I'm going to practice and I'm going to make sure that I become my own boss as a golfer and I'm going to work hard enough to succeed. I think I was naive as a 16-year-old who was in full-time employment. I left school at 15. I went straight into work in a pro shop because I needed some money. And it was a case of, I'm just going to work before work and after work to work on my game, because I didn't know any different. I didn't know what it took for Seve or Faldo or Woosnam or, you know, the greats in Europe that I'd watched play golf. I didn't know their journey because I didn't read books. I don't like reading books today. So I didn't kind of look into how the dynamics of that work. So I was just naive and I just thought, well, if I practice hard, just like Faldo practiced hard and all the other guys, then, you know, I'm gonna get there. So I think the naivety and the fact of not knowing and not knowing any different and not saying that, you know, what made Faldo great? Why was he good? He wasn't born with the gift of talent to become a major champion. Surely it's just down to hard work. So I just told myself, if you keep working hard and keep practicing, then surely, you know, that, you know, it will pay off.
So this is fascinating, Matthew.
This is
fascinating because surely, Pulse, you must have had some kind of talent for golf, because what I'm listening to, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Matthew, you come in. Now, your talent was football, you wanted to be a footballer, but because of your hard work and dedication, you become a great golfer. Is that purely down to hard work and dedication? Because then, if you're saying to, like, your son, you know, I've seen him on the TV hitting golf balls, brilliant, you must have a natural talent, surely, in that field.
Can I throw a quick question to add to that as well, Ian? Because what fascinates me about this, you're 15 years old, 16 years old, working in a pro shop. The distance between where you were as a golfer then and where you needed to get to, the skill you needed to build through time. When you were waking up early to go and practice before. You went, what was the voice in your head saying, right, I need to get down to the driving range. I need to get down to the putting green. Because that sounds to me that the motivation was coming from deep within you. I know rejection was part of it, but I'd love to know what was motivating you to wake up so early when the distance to where you needed to get to was vast.
Well, yeah, and it was vast, but I think the simplicity of it was, you know, obviously, you know, I gravitated to sport. I wanted to be a sportsman. So, you know, at school I played in the cricket team, I played in the basketball team, I was county champion at pole vaulting, I did all these little bits were sport. I hated school. I hated it. I didn't wanna listen, I didn't wanna do you know, science, and I didn't want to do all of the lessons at school, history and all that stuff. It didn't resonate with me at all. So I literally, my brain switched off to what school really was. I wish I'd done better now today with everything that I need to have with me. I wish I'd have learned a language and done all of that stuff, which I keep telling my kids today that it's an amazing skill to have. And you know, you should be a straight A student, but you know, back then I literally pushed it to one side and I just told myself in my mind, I'm going to be a sportsman. That's all I care about. And I'm going to do whatever it takes to get to that next level. My brother was 2 years older, so he was always better at me than golf. That was a good inspiration for me to always try and beat him as soon as I possibly could. So there was some great rivalry there. And from that point, you know, I always looked up to people and always wanted to learn from people that were older, that were better than me. So there was a pro at the golf course who was playing on the European tour and I used to drive him to the airport. You know, I used to take him to the airport. I used to pick him up from the airport and he used to pay me with a dozen golf balls, which he got for free. So, but I would learn little bits from him and we'd go out and we'd play golf. So it was the fact of always wanting to associate and be around winners and be around people that are better than you, to learn all the little bits you possibly can, which I think are part of the journey that I've had.
So listening to that, right? So when people listen to this podcast and this, you know, parents and children listen to it, you make it sound so easy that if you've got a desire and a dedication at such a young age and you've got this dream of being a golfer and you go and hit loads and loads of balls and do everything you can, give up stuff, choose the right pathway, you can become a golfer. But I can't picture that because everybody would do it. Not everybody, but the rewards are incredible. You know, the lifestyle in traveling the world's incredible. You know, you've got a great relationship with your caddy. The benefits are amazing. So if that was as easy as that, surely there'd be loads of kids who would become golfers. You must have some talent.
Rob, that's not what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing here is what you have is a young person with incredible discipline, with incredible motivation. Most important thing, a learning mindset, willing to listen, willing to drive someone to the airport, take them back to pick up those nuggets of information that can help him become the best he can be. I agree with you, Rob. Ian definitely has some talent.
Got to have talent.
For sure. Of course. But think about, for me, the bigger picture is what he's done with his talent. That's the inspirational bit, maximising his talent. That's what I want the young people to hear here. They might not be interested in golf. They might not be interested in sport. They may be interested in something else. They may not reach, you know, they might not win a Nobel Prize, but with that, I think for me, the most interesting interview we've done so far, because what it's capturing is something about motivation and discipline and that ability to cope with rejection. I'm genuinely fascinated by this.
It gives me goosebumps, right? Because, you know, for me, when I sit and reflect upon, you know, the 21 years I've played on tour, and I get asked it a lot, and we've spoke about it in numerous different kind of interview scenarios, and people ask the question, you know, why, how have you got to where you've got? And I'm a firm believer in if you have 100% focus, dedication, and confidence, that you belong where you belong. And this is where the whole mental health situation comes in. This is where rejection, this is where people who take things personally when bad things are said to them can hurt them along the way. You know, I truly believe that if you've got good people around you and people around you, and there should only be one handful, two handfuls maximum of people around you, and if you keep a very constant, tight-knit group that are good people, and they're going to nurture you and push you in the right direction and help you when you need the help, because it's not all plain sailing. And obviously what I've said, it sounds very easy just to achieve, hey, you play football, but now you play golf and you've become pretty good. It's not as easy as that. There's highs and lows and peaks and troughs throughout the whole of my career. And it's about the people that you've got around you to help just when you need it. When you're down, you know, someone to pick you up, someone to tell you that you're working on the right things. And it's the inner belief that, you know, that you've got the ability of somebody else. You might look up to them. You might think they're absolutely incredible. But why? Why are they any different to you? And that's the thing that I'll always pull from. Seve, watching Seve practice from the bunker, watching him shape shots through the trees, you know, Faldo's kind of his mindset with the precision of being, you know, that methodical guy that just was a number crunching guy, right? You take a little bit from everybody that you like and you try and blend that into yourself. And that's kind of how I did it. And that's my feeling of what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a little bit of everyone and try to become the best person I can.
So David Beckham puts, when I grew up in the class of 92, after training, he would hit 100, 200 free kicks against, you know, at the goal and at the cliff, and he'd hit the wall behind numerous times, but he was there, first in, last out. And as a youngster, you know, how many golf balls would you hit? You know, there'd be mornings, I'm sure, you woke up and think, oh, I can't be bothered today, but you'd be there, wouldn't you?
You put the work in, right? Apart from, you know, on the way into work, popping into McDonald's to get a little breakfast and then going to hit some balls, right? What, you know, working your hours in the shop and having these little windows of opportunity to go and practice, you know, it's all about, you know, what you can take from the opportunities of practice. And I did it very different to the modern day golfer. The modern day golfer today didn't do it like I did. He didn't work in a pro shop. He played his amateur career. He was very good. You know, he all of a sudden went to college. He was known globally. And then he bursts out on the scene and becomes a good golfer. So, you know, not many people have done it that way. And it's not easy, but it does come down, you know, the 10,000 hours, the dedication, the hard work that you put in. You will reap the rewards if you believe you're going down the right path. And if you believe that you've got the ability to get to the next level. I mean, how many football players did you play with that are great, great players that probably weren't great players at an early age, but become very good players?
Yeah, they're the slow burners. They're the ones who, you know, you wait for.
It's a great point. And you know, what you were saying there about that synthesis, that combination of passion, knowing you're doing what you really want to be doing, and then the commitment on the other hand. I mean, how perfect a storm is that in a young person aspiring to be a sporting champion? Let me just ask you this. Ian, you know, a lot of people think of golfers and, you know, the country club and all the rest. Are you very posh? Your parents and go on. No. Just give us paint a picture of what it was like. You grew up in Stevenage.
So I grew up in Stevenage in a terraced house, one of a block of, I don't know, 16 houses in a row, wedged together, small three bedroom house. You know, I used to watch my dad play football at a weekend. I went to work from the age of 11 on a market stall because I just needed some money. Never wanted to ask mum and dad for money because they never had it. So, you know, I wanted to buy a bike. I wanted to save up for a car. So, you know, I did the Wednesday morning before school, went, set up a market stall, packed it away Wednesday night, did it on a Saturday morning, played my football, and just kind of, you know, I just didn't want to ask for anything because I just didn't feel it was the right thing to do. So, you know,
didn't have any money. It's not like you, right? And so, you know, a lot of people think of those who achieve in a sport like golf, they need to have been born with a silver spoon. They needed the membership of one of the great. You did it the hard way, Rob. I've got to tell you, Ian said you don't read that much. He's got to write a book. You probably have written it.
I have got an autobiography out. Yeah, we did one. It's only the second book I've ever read.
it's my first book, like.
No Limits is my book, and it kind of it stands for what it says, really, to be honest. And just, you know, just being a kid and just wanting to be, you know, I just wanted to be successful. Just sick of people saying you can't do something, because I don't believe that to be true. And I just think that, you know, there was two school teachers at school that I loved, right? My English teacher, who I'm still in touch with today, he came to my wedding. Wow. He's one of the, you know, he's a great guy. And there was just two that got who I was as an individual. You know, one of which was somebody that caught me going to the golf club with my clubs on my back. And I went into school the following day, and he says, how was you yesterday? Was you not feeling very well? No, I was sick. He says, well, you didn't look that sick walking up the hill to the golf course as I drove past. So, you know, he understood me as who I was. But it's, you know, I'm not trying to say kids should be skipping school. I mean, school is extremely important, but you should have the belief and the vision of where you want to go, and you should follow those dreams, because I think it's, you know, in today's society, it's too easy to give kids all a medal, right?
Yeah.
And it was highlighted 2 days ago. My son plays a match. It's for districts and school. He shoots low round. There's another kid who's on the same score. So they go into a playoff to win. They play three playoff holes. They make par on all three playoff holes. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. There's plenty of daylight left. They chose to give them both a trophy. Sorry, that doesn't work in my mind. You're not teaching a 16-year-old how to win, right? And that's really important down the line. And I feel, you know, I know it's hard, and I know it's very, very difficult to be able, for some people, to understand what it's like and the disappointment of not winning. But it's part of the lesson. It's part of what sport is. We can't win. I mean, every time I go and play golf, I've only won 16 tournaments out of the 600 I've won. But you have to get used to the disappointment of not winning. You have to learn to live with that. If you do something and you all get a trophy for it, what does it mean? It means nothing. And, you know, that's something that burns in me as well. It's about winning and losing and understanding the difference of that.
So what are you like as a parent, Pulse?
Yeah.
So for me, as a parent, my son's at Manchester United Academy, and, you know, I've spoke about this on other podcasts we've done, where when I go and watch him, there's more pressure on him because I'm his father. So what are you like with your boy when you go and watch him at a golf tournament, when other people will see you're there and that's your son? You know, what is it like watching for you now as a parent?
Well, it's difficult, right? Because you want to help them. Because you've been there, you've done it, you really want to help. And in some ways, that's also difficult as well, because they want to show you and prove to you that they are good enough as well. And that's a really, there's a fine line to walk, and it's not easy. So what, you know, I say to Luke, often I say, hey, do you want me to come and watch? And at the minute he's like, no, I'm all good. So I leave him to do his work, because is very difficult, I think. You know, I don't know what that's like, but to be a son of somebody who's good at a sport, and for your kid to want to do the same sport, it's never easy. Not many kids actually have that opportunity to make it to that level, right? So, you know, he wants it. He wants it badly, and, you know, I'm happy to help him along that way. If he wants me at the tournament and I'm not playing, I'm going to be at that tournament and I'm going to give him the support. If he doesn't want me there, then that's fine, because I know it adds that extra pressure, but I think he's already got the pressure. And I think by him playing well and coming home saying, hey, listen, I was low medalist today, that's his way of showing that, you know, he's on the right path, he's doing good for himself, and I want him to grow into himself and enjoy. I don't want to put the pressure on. He's got enough pressure as it is. And I think pressure for kids today is overwhelming. The parent pressure is overwhelming. You know, when you look at Ozil today, earning 400 grand a week and doesn't make the team, right? It's such an extravagant amount of money to be paid to in today's world that, you know, parents want their kids to succeed and they will push them really, really hard. And sometimes I feel they've just got to take a step back and say, look, we're here for support and we'll give you whatever it is you need, but, you know, go along that journey and you know, if you need anything, let us know. And, you know, I'm trying to do that with Luke. I do push him down the path of where he needs to go, and I do help him out, you know, as much as I possibly can, but I want him to learn the journey and I want him to have that journey for himself. And if he makes it, amazing. You know what? I couldn't be more proud. And if he doesn't make it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because it's great life lessons along the way.
But can I just come in there? Because as well, you've talked about your humble background. You know, you're brought up in a terraced house, a street at 16, and your passion, after being told you weren't good enough, your self-drive, your self-motivation, you became a golfer. Luke's environment and surroundings are completely the opposite, you know, from where he is now, you know, because of your illustrious career and what you've achieved in your life. So for Luke, you know, it's got to come even more within, if you know what I mean, because he's got a great lifestyle because of your success. Do you understand what I mean?
100%. And a couple of years ago, I did a piece for my school, and it was amazing, because at the time I had two kids. So this is going back probably 10 years. And I said to Luke and Amy at the time, I said, right, I'm going to take you to the street where I grew up in. So at the time I was driving a Rolls Royce back home. So we jumped in the Rolls Royce. We drove down, you know, Canterbury Way. I parked out the front of what my old house was, 405 Canterbury Way. And obviously the cars are not Rolls Royces. They're very, very different. And I remember getting the kids out of the car and I'm like, look, this is where I lived for 20 years. This is where I grew up. This is where, you know, I would go over to the fields to hit golf balls. That was my bedroom at the front of the house. And it was even smaller than what I ever remembered it. So, you know, you've always got to kind of, in those instances, show them kind of reality and what's actually real. You know, all this stuff around me here and all this, you know, it's fairyland stuff, to be honest. None of it's real, right? It's stuff that dreams are made of. And, you know, for kids, you know, you have to, especially from where I stand, you keep having to ask the question, how much do you want it? How much do you really want it?
Ian, you know, everything you're saying today, honestly, you're just saying it 10 times better than I could say. It's so similar to the way I think about life and parenting. I often get it wrong, to be honest. The thing I find toughest, Ian, is, you know, like, you know that your son or daughter's got a passion. You know they care about what they're doing. You know that they really want to be the best they can be. But there's a week or maybe even a month where they kind of don't really want to do it. You know, they had a bad result. You know, the motivation's dipped. How hard do you push at that point? You know, how do you get the balance between giving them the space to pursue their passion on the one hand, in giving them the nudge that you know they need, but you worry that you're going to alienate them in some way? Do you find that tough?
I do find it tough, but I think, you know, I try and, you know, again, I'll refer to Luke. Luke played a tournament a week ago, and if he finished top five, it gave him an exemption to play in all the rest of the tournaments. Great. He finished sixth. He missed a 4-foot putt on the last. And he's angry, he's distraught, and I'm like, good.
Yeah.
I hope it hurts, because I've been there and I've done it, and it should hurt. And if you walked away from the tournament and it didn't hurt inside, then you're probably going down the wrong path. So it's a way of explaining the feelings of what he's having inside, which is the anger, the frustration, the disappointment, all of that. But on the second breath, it's like we'll evaluate all of the good stuff he's done and say, look, you're heading on the right path. You're playing good golf. You know, keep working on the things you're working on because you are doing good things. So I think it's about the balance of how you try and give them the nudge in a way by telling them it should hurt, and I hope it hurts, and you shouldn't miss that putt. You shouldn't miss the 4-foot putt. If you'd have worked a bit harder, to be honest, you know, you probably wouldn't hold the 4-foot putt. So, but things happen. It's about how you deal with the disappointment about going forward, and it's about taking that passion and the frustration that's inside you and blending that into your practice session the next time you go out. And you know, it's an incredible motivator.
That's fantastic. Rob, can I jump in? I know you've got a lot to say there.
Yeah, yeah.
Ian, during the podcast, all of the podcasts, we ask every guest three set questions. So this is question number one. What was the weakest part of your skills as a golfer and the thing you had to work the hardest on to improve?
The weakest part of my skills. I think really the course management side of things. Always being too aggressive, always going for, you know, the glory shot. And I think, you know, learning and understanding that it's not all about trying to hit it to 5 feet on every hole. It's about learning your job, basically, and it's about learning the trade of what it is you're doing. So I think, you know, learning how to become a consistent top level golfer, and learning along the way to be able to piece together, because good's good, and when you do great stuff, we know, you know, most top level sportsmen, along the way, their great is amazing, but it's about how good their bad is. So managing the bad.
Do you know what, Paul? Before you come on, me and Matthew were doing our intro, and I'm not going to let Matthew get away with this. So we were talking about, I said, you don't have to to win majors to be a great golfer. And there's, Matthew will have a side and you'll have a side. But I believe if you've won what you've won, achieved what you've won, you're a great golfer. I believe if you make a career out of being a footballer at League Two level, if you can pay the bills of being a footballer, for me, you're a very, very good footballer. If you play Championship, you're a great footballer. If you play Premier League, you know, you're at the top. And if you play Champions League, unbelievable. So for me, you don't have to win a major to be a great golfer. How many people want to be a golfer? How many people actually can survive on the tour? And then how many people can actually win one tournament? You've said what you've won. So I believe you don't have to win a major to be a great golfer. I think you're a great golfer. Is that fair? You're not going to say you're a great golfer, but do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, let me jump in as well. So yeah. we're talking about what it is. It's like in golf, Robbie's hilarious. What it is to be an all-time great. And I, you know, I'm not an expert on golf. Obviously, I got a lower handicap than you. But I watch all the majors. I watch the Ryder Cup. I think it's probably, with the possible exception of tennis, football's great too. For spectator sport, it is brilliant. Watching people going up the inward nine on the final day of a major, the pressure, the intensity, the fact that it's all on that individual. Ryder Cup, that it's drama that you just can't, you know, it's beautiful stuff. But for a golfer, what is it like when you're talking to other professionals? Is winning a major like what it takes to be an all-time great? Or does it matter? How do people have that conversation from your neck of the woods?
It's difficult, right? Because I haven't won one. So I'd like to turn around and say I have won one. So we've got one coming up in a couple of weeks. And hopefully I slide that lovely green jacket on. But, you know, when... it's one of those benchmark things, right? There's four majors a year. There's a stigma around becoming a major champion. But for me, I'm content. From where I've come from to the career I've had today at 44, like if something happened and I had to put my clubs away today, like I could put my feet up, relax, and actually say I'm very happy with the journey I had. And I think, you know, when you look at majors and when you look at who's won the majors in the last 20 years and you think Tiger's had 14, you've Mickelson's had 6 and Harrington's had 3 and, you know, Sergio and da-da-da. Like, a lot of those majors have been won by a few people. You know, Jordan Spieth, Rory McIlroy, you know. If you take all of those and add them all up, they basically scoop them all up. It's the same as tennis. If you was a tennis player playing in the era of Federer, Djokovic, Nadal, you'd be like, oh, for God's sake, how much, you know, you could be a great tennis player, one of the world's top 10 players.
Totally.
You're not going to win a major.
Yeah.
Not going to win a major.
That's true.
So
that's true.
You know, I'd love to win one. I've been runner-up. I've finished third. I've been oh so close, but I haven't put my fingers on one. So, for me, my performances. You know, I'm probably known more for playing my performances in the Ryder Cup than individually because I haven't won a major. You know, second best to a major's WGCs. I've won 2. So, I'd love to win one, just to. It would be nice to win one, right? But it doesn't matter if I don't.
I think, Pulse, I think you're a great golfer, even if Matthew doesn't.
I'll tell you this right now. I'd be happier today.
I knew you'd do that. I knew it.
He's throwing you right under the bus there, isn't he? He's throwing you under the bus. I would take today, if someone said to me, would you like to win a major or would you like your son to win a major? All day long, right now, I would take if Luke was to win one. Or Joshua.
Yeah.
All day long. I'm happy. I'm happy with my journey. I'd be even more thrilled if it was them.
Can I ask you, which is a wonderful thing. I was talking about the intensity near the end of a major. Rob mentioned in the intro, Jean van der Velde at the Open 1 year. I think it's Carnoustie.
I shouldn't laugh.
It's awful. I interviewed him. Honestly, he was still devastated by it, like 15 years later. But also Greg Norman at the Masters.
Masters, you know, I remember with Faldo. Norman,
with Faldo, but also with Norman.
Imagine Matthew's interview, Pulse. Imagine Matthew's interview with van der Velde on the last.
Yeah, I'm
obviously,
sure that's awesome.
You're not a great golfer because you've not won. Never mind.
But the amazing, Rob, do you remember? I think he needed a double bogey on the 18th to win. And he got a triple bogey. Went into a playoff with, I'm trying to think who it was.
Paul Laurie. See, you should know
Paul
that.
Paul Laurie.
You only remember, and he played his last main European tour event 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
Van der Velde or Laurie?
The Laurie.
Paul Laurie. Listen, Van der Velde was done years ago.
But can I just ask you, mentally, like in table tennis, if you're under pressure, you can play a topspin and give yourself a margin for error. Whereas in golf, if you get the club face at a slightly wrong angle, it could be 1 degree out, you can hit the ball into the rough. When you're going up the inward nine of a major or you're in the Ryder Cup and you know you have to get a par or a birdie to win a hole, How do you marshal your expertise without losing it with nerves and with the, because it must jangle in your fingertips when you're wielding.
You know, I think it goes down. It goes all the way back to instincts. It goes back to all of the hours you've spent on the training pitch, on the practice ground, doing your trade. So I think, you know, everything you've done goes out the window. All the textbook stuff about, you know, how to make sure you swing, it all goes out the window. You literally play from feel and instinct, and that's what carries you through. Some people thrive being under more pressure, and some people kind of shrink under that kind of pressure. And everyone's different. Not everybody's built the same. Not everybody's built to accept all, you know, that adrenaline rush as well as other people. And that's what makes certain people stand out in sport. And, you know, it's just you pull from everything that you've done in the past. And I'll explain it like it's an archive. So if there's a shot I need to hit under pressure,
right,
I'll always open that drawer and I'll scroll through the folder and I'll pull out the shot that I need to pull out, because I'm sure I've hit it in the past. I'm sure I have. So it's about learning the folder to be able to go in to pull upon that shot and just literally play it from instinct.
Love that. Love
that's
that.
The same with the, that's the same. The practice. David Beckham, all those free kicks. Greece, Old Trafford for England. Do you remember it? He's hit that free kick
top
before.
Corner.
Practice, practice, practice.
Beautiful.
Made it easier for him. It would have made it easier for him. So therefore, the bigger the, and again, goosebump moment, like the bigger the moment, actually, the easier it becomes, because he's not really expected to score that free kick.
Yeah.
We'd love him to, right? And he did, but it's almost, you know, you're just praying that he does, but it makes it easier for him. It takes the pressure off because he knows he's done it 1,000 times.
And, you know, funnily enough, Robbie knows this. I spent quite a lot of time with David in his final season at Paris Saint-Germain. And he said on that the Greece game, Teddy Sheringham tried to take the ball off him just before he took that free kick because he had missed 2 or 3 in that match. And he almost said exactly the words you said. He said, I went back into my mind, all of those shots that I'd taken, all of those disciplined, repetitive practice, and it gave me the confidence to kick it, believing that I was going to score it. I think that's just such an incredibly powerful thing. But let me ask you, Rob, stop it. Let me just ask the second question quickly. Of the set questions, Mike. I'm doing it, Mike. What is the one thing you haven't got talent in, but you wish you had?
What's the one area that I haven't got talent in that I wish I had?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be in golf. It could be in life. What's the thing you wish you could do?
I mean, if it was golf, I'd love to hit it 50 yards further. I can't, right? Because it would make the game a lot easier. In life, I'd love to become a better dad.
Oh, that's a great answer. Don't you think, Rob, he'd be a brilliant manager, like a football manager?
Yeah.
Given what he said, you know, I'm inspired by talking to you, Ian. Honestly, I mean that. And I listen to a lot of people in lots of different contexts, sport, business, political. Robbie, what do you think? He's got all of the attributes as a leader.
Yeah, and as somebody who loves the Ryder Cup Pulse, when you're there in that Ryder Cup team, I'm sure Matthew will talk about Medina and what you achieved. That team sport, that spirit. I try and motivate my team now as youngsters, and I try and relay, tell them about my past experiences and how they can try and relate to it. And when I watch you at the Ryder Cup, the goosebumps when you cheat, the crowd are getting going. You're that
fantastic.
You're that person that in that team that we can all relate to. Do you know what I mean? So that's why I think Pulse would be a great manager, motivator, I'm sure an inspiration to thousands of kids who play golf, you know, because of that Ryder Cup moment, that team ethic. And maybe it means more to you, Pulse, because you were told you weren't good enough at 15 in a team sport. I don't know.
Yeah, I love the team atmosphere, the team buzz. There's nothing like team. And that's something that, you know, I've always, as the kid who was 15 years of age at the Ryder Cup at the Belfry, where I snuck underneath the ropes because I couldn't see anything. And I sat right there on the, just to the right of the bunker on 18. I watched Seve play his bunker shot over the water. And, you know, it was what it meant to see the chemistry between Seve and Alathabal. You know, that was a partnership that was absolutely incredible. You know, all of the matches they played it with passion. They played it to win. And over their dead body, were they going to lay down at any stage of the game and let anyone have a sniff of a chance to win a hole? And win, lose or draw, they walked off that golf course exhausted. Mm. And that's one thing that, you know, when I play Ryder Cup, I'm toast for 3 weeks. You might as well just leave me in a room for 3 weeks and let me come out the other end and I'll be fine. But for, you know, I'll have cold sores 3 days later. I physically can't get out of bed. I'm emotionally spent. Wow. And it's everything which, I mean, listen, you've been there. You've been in big matches, right? You know, it's the build-up. It's the drama. It's the pressure. It's the excitement. It's the, you know, what's going to happen. It's the actual match itself. You give that extra piece. And therefore, you know, you live and die by the sword, and you get out what you put in, and you know, it's all about, you know, what level you're going to go to win your match.
This is a perfect moment to bring in the final question in. Thank you. This is just such a good interview. What is the best piece of advice anyone has ever given you, and who said it?
The best piece of advice. Do you know what? It's interesting. I wouldn't say there's really been any piece of advice. I would, you know, there's too many tiny little snippets along the way from Ryder Cup captains and bits of inspiration and Alathabal's emotions at Ryder Cups and all of those little bits. And I think for me, it might go to Michael Jordan. When Michael Jordan at Medina was trying to mess with me and get in my face at the Ryder Cup to try and do what he wanted to do, to put the influence to try and turn our match out so the Americans win that match. And I think the bit for me was, as a sports fan, as Michael Jordan, I watched the piece on Netflix, which was Last Dance, which gave me goosebumps the whole way through it. I thought it was absolutely remarkable who he is, the character he is, what he gives for his teammates and what he gives for himself to be able to pull out the shot at the right moment. I'm like, Michael Jordan's, he's messing with me. It's the biggest compliment that anybody could have ever given any individual is from one of the greatest in sport today that's ever lived. He's trying to mess with me. So he didn't have to say anything. It was what he did in his own right, which actually inspired me to play even better and bring out the best in me. And he wrote, I asked him to write a quote on the back of my autobiography, which he did. But I think, you know, without saying anything, that's the most inspirational thing that someone's ever done is given me that level of respect in trying to mess with me.
That is fascinating, Rob. Don't you think? That's and Jordan, did you watch The Last Dance, Roberto?
I've not seen it yet, no.
It's incredible.
I'm going to watch it, yeah.
I've got to tell you, this guy, Jordan, he's epic because he took a failing basketball franchise and through will and galvanising the other people.
Was it Scottie Pippen? Scottie Pippen's in it.
Pippen's in the team. There's this guy called Steve Kerr. What did you think was the best episode? Yeah, I mean, that was an incredible one. He lost his dad, didn't he, in the Middle East. And he's now a great coach, by the way. What an extraordinary...
Brilliant.
And he got that basket. Jordan went to him in the dying moment. I mean, it's just a beautiful... Actually,
that's
on Jordan, Paul, amazing. Just incredible. On that, by the way, Jordan, one of the greats. I couldn't agree with you more. Where does Woods fit into that kind of pantheon of all-time great sports people? And what was it like for you to play against him?
He's right there. And I think when there will be a documentary come out about what he's done in the game of golf, which will be I think it's easy to forget as a current player, someone that's played against him, still playing against him, what he's done for the sport and in the sport and personally from a win ratio perspective. His record is without doubt possibly going to go down as the best. I know he hasn't quite got the majors that Jack's got, but when you look at the bigger picture of how many wins, the way he's won, the dominance, the win ratio that he had, is absolutely remarkable. You know, last year at Saturday at the Masters, I'm paired with Tiger, and you know, obviously he went on to win. He shot 6 under on that Saturday, I shot 5 under. I mean, you know, you draw inspiration from playing with the greats. There's nothing better than when you have that opportunity to play with someone who, from a golf perspective, you look up to, and you know, someone who's done what he's done. It kind of pulls you along.
You know, you talk about the advice, obviously not in terms of verbally from Jordan. What's the best advice you would give to Luke? You know, your son.
The best advice I would give, I would just keep reiterating the fact of how much do you want it? How much do you really want it? Because I was a 4-handicap golfer at the age of 17. That's as low as I got as a handicap golfer. So, you know, I wasn't that good in technical terms as an amateur. And, you know, from where he is today as a golfer who goes out, I mean, he's had 12 under par rounds in his last 18 rounds of golf. So, you know, he's good, but he's still a long way from where he needs to be against the best kids that are out there at the minute. And for me, it's kind of a slow burner with him. I don't need Luke to be thrown up there in the spotlight because that's even more pressure than what he's got already. So for me, it's about, look, time's on your side. Take your time. Learn your trade. Let's kind of give you all the information you need. You've got a leg up because of everything around us today that we can assist him with. But it's a case of, I'll always ask him the question, how much do you really want it? Because that was the bit that burned inside me that made me want, you know, I had to do it because I wanted to do it. And it's just too easy. It would be too easy for him to, you know, to give up, right? Because we're always going to be able to look after Luke, and you know, he's my son. But I'll always ask the question.
Can I just throw this in? Is that as kind of like final couple of minutes, Pulse? And thanks for staying on a bit longer. But this has just been so interesting.
Don't even know what the time is.
It's just flown. It's flown like an hour plus. But I'm guessing, given what you said, you would love to step up and be a Ryder Cup captain. I'm almost thinking that goes without saying. But here's just one question, because I know there'll be a lot of golf enthusiasts tuning in. You've mentioned Woods is one of the all-time greats. You know, Nicklaus, what a player. I was lucky enough to interview him at St. Andrews once. Fascinating mindset. He talked about the archive as well, by the way. Didn't use that phrase, but very similar way of thinking about tough shots. But if you had to pick a golfer who maximised their talents, a person who took what they had and eked the most out of it. I have a lot of admiration for those kinds of people. If you had to pick a golfer who has that attribute, who would you pick?
Really interesting question. There, you know, I would say probably someone like Harrington. Won 3 majors.
Amazing.
You know, amazing, really, when you look at, you know, I don't know what his amateur record was like, but when you talk to someone like Paul McGinley, who played with him, who said he hit it all over the place as a kid growing up, and he might not have been, you know, the most gifted, you know, naturally talented looking swinger of the golf club, but you know what, his trophy cabinet looks pretty damn good today with 3 of those majors, Matthew.
Touché. And listen, Pulse, I just want to reiterate, Rob,
incredible,
it's been fantastic, hasn't it? Wow. That was just so good, and thank you for joining us.
Pleasure, guys. Absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Fantastic.
And please remember, people listening in, to rate and review us wherever you get your podcast. Do spread the word about this pod. We'll be back next week, but for now, from all of us, goodbye.